Well, on almost any indicator you care to mention, Australia is a wealthy nation. As a country, we've experienced steady economic growth really since the 1950s and spectacular growth since the mid-1990s with the bump of the Great Recession in 2009, which was painful for some of us, but on a world scale hit us barely a scratch. And we're now talking about the next boom. Australia is a member of that group of the richest nations on Earth, and it's pretty close to the top. You can back that up with a bit of data. In 2004, the Australian economy grew by $25 billion. Our GDP has doubled since 1980, and on present indicators, it will double again by the time in the next few years, and will quadruple by the time you're ready to retire. Since the 1950s, wages have increased in real terms to be three times higher what they were then. That's with everything taken into account, with inflation and the cost of housing, everything. You will now, on average, have an income three times higher than it would have been in the 50s. Our wages have got bigger and our houses have got bigger. Since 1985, our houses have increased by 31%. And our houses have got bigger at the very time when the amount of people occupying them has got smaller. So in the 1950s, the average house had 3.6 people in it. That's down to 2.6 people by the year 2000. So for every house, a whole person has vanished from each one of those houses. In 1970, the average house had 40 square metres per person. Today, it typically has 85 square metres per person. The space of our houses is bigger, our wages are bigger, the ability to afford a second car, to travel and have luxury products and so on has grown to a rate that would be staggering to our grandparents. If you wonder about where you fit in this, you can think about the situation of Occupy Wall Street or Occupy Perth or whatever, where one of the catchphrases has been, "We are the 99%. And there's a 1% that are making it difficult for the 99%. But if you think about it on a global scale, who are the 1%? Who is that tiny group that is ruining it for the rest of, well, us? Well, on a world scale, if you're on the dole in Australia, then you are in the top 11.6% of world earners. So just by receiving the looking for work wage, you're in the 11.6. On the minimum wage, you're in the top 7.3 earners in the world of all time. And to enter that precious 1% against which the rest of the world is protesting, you just need an average wage for a West Australian. The average wage of about $72,000 gets you into the top 0.85% of wage earners in the world. So if the Occupy World Wall Street became Occupy Western Australia, the vast majority of us would be in the 1% that the rest are hunting down. Well, I can tell you all that about the increase in real wages and the fact that being on the dole in Australia puts you in the top 10% of world wage earners and so on, and point out the time that we're living in. But really, I don't need to, because you see it everywhere. Everywhere you go in this country, as a direct consequence of our increase in wealth, everyone is happy. I'm sure you noticed that on the way here. As you left work, at work, people were just singing and smiling and saying, "Isn't this good?" And if you're on 70k or more, you're in the top 1%, and this is amazing. And then I'm sure as you go back to work this afternoon, people, random strangers, will just hug you and say, "Listen, I don't know who you are, but can we celebrate this moment together?" And then no doubt at the end of the day, the director of your section or your boss will say, "Listen, we're going to go home, but could we just pray before we go and just thank God for another day where we've received so much from his hand?" It's just not like that, is it? For some reason, this massive increase in wealth and possession and wage and so on has not resulted in a country that is just happy and grateful and thankful. And if that's a question that strikes you as a question worth thinking about, it struck the writer of Ecclesiastes as well. If you've been with us over the past few weeks, we've seen that this guy really has one central idea, that life is vaporous, that it's havel, that it's misty, that it's enigmatic, that it's hard to grab onto. And he's been testing that thesis against all sorts of things, against power and justice and so on. And this week we see that he tests his thesis against wealth, which on the surface seems like the least likely thing to fit with his theory, because at least wealth and possessions do exist in the real world in a way that justice kind of doesn't. That he says, well, wealth, there's something that you can own. Does it fit with my thesis that life is fundamentally transient and passing? And he says, it does. His contention is that even here at the point of wealth and wages and possessions, something mysterious happens where the thing that we chase, the thing that we try to possess, does not deliver the kind of fulfillment that you might expect. So in chapter 5 and verse 10 he says, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This is, well, vaporous. This is enigmatic. Why is it that wealth doesn't deliver that sense of fulfillment? Well, I think the teacher and the rest of the Bible have two reasons: greed on the one hand and envy on the other. Greed and envy both conspiring to make wealth something that doesn't deliver lasting satisfaction. Consider first of all greed. Greed is that inordinate kind of desire to possess and retain that which you have owned. And he says in chapter 5 and verse 10, those who love money never have enough. His claim is that there's something about the desire to possess that does not ultimately fulfill. We're told, at least I got the statistics for America, that in the United States, an average citizen comes into contact with about 9,000 advertising messages a day. I don't mean literally 9,000 ads on telly, but 9,000 times a day. Somewhere in their focal view or in their hearing, they're exposed to an advertisement. So say Australia, maybe it's slightly less at 8,000 or something like that. Think about the narrative of advertising. The narrative of all advertising, I think, is to say that you have a need, perhaps a need you weren't aware of, and our product or service will fulfill that need. So a few years ago, the ad was, are you feeling 100%? Well, Centrum can help. And I see that ad and think, yeah, I'm not feeling 100%. How did they know? Like, and so what it does is creates a little narrative in your life where there's a gap and there's a product that fills the gap. So is your skin looking tired and haggard? You think, how? It's like they've got a camera into my world. Well, Oil of Ulan can help. Or are you having trouble meeting women? And you think, well, it's not, you know, your social skills or the fact that you're just nasty. It's just kind of the male pattern baldness. And advanced hair will certainly bring that into relief and you'll find the women that you want to meet. Think about the psychological impact of that. If 8,000 times a day you're told a story, and the story is that there is something that you lack, and there's a product or service that can fulfill that void. It's like again and again a gospel is preached to us of lack, fulfillment. And it's left us, to quote one social commentator, feeling deprived, inadequate, anxious. And it's axiomatic that advertisements make us feel bad in a way that can be cured by the possession of the products they advertise. It's interesting in the Bible that greed is seen or is associated with the biblical idea of idolatry. That there's almost a quasi-religious angle to the experience of greed, that greed is in some sense a competitor with the worship of God. And you can see something like that if you just stop and listen to the nature of the advertising that we hear. I did this exercise of thinking, what in one section of ads, what are the promises that are made to you in between television shows? Here's one sample. A series of ads on television offered power, peace, status, revival, access to a different dimension, freedom, reconciliation, and spirituality. And the products that were offered were tea, a new mobile phone, holidays, and footwear. Incredibly spiritual language about incredibly kind of less than spiritual things. And the net effect is to keep consumers in one of the richest societies in human history feeling deprived. The nature of greed is not only quasi-religious, spiritual in the sense of its promises, but it's almost eschatological. It looks toward the end, a bit like the cults do, the kind of cults that are advertising the exact moment of God's return and so on. Advertising promises fulfillment, but of course we know that the product doesn't deliver that fulfillment, so it always promises the fulfillment in the future. It's always the next product, it's always the next wage rise, it's always the next thing that will deliver what the last thing clearly didn't. Those who love money never have enough, and those who love wealth are never satisfied. But on the other side of greed, of course, is envy. If greed is the inordinate desire to possess for yourself, envy is that habit of life of working out your happiness, not based on your own contentment, but on the things that others possess. If greed says, can I have more, envy says, I at least need more than her. Back in chapter 4, verse 4, it says, I saw all the toil and achievement that springs from one person's envy of another. Consider the Australian barbecue. Some of you are old enough to remember the barbecue as a sign of Australian egalitarianism. That in up until the 1980s, a barbecue could just be a piece of cast iron kind of metal under a 44-gallon drum with wood underneath it, and it was kind of grotty and scary to think about the hygiene of that thing. But there it was, cooking your sausages. But somewhere in the late 80s, someone blew the whistle and turned barbecues from a symbol of what we share to a symbol of what divides us. And so no longer do we have the same thing, we have different things, things that distinguish us. So at barbecues galore, you can get a thing called the Grand Turbo. Maybe you have this. If you don't, it has electronic multi-spark plugs. It has a deluxe cast iron plate. It's got a roasting hood, and it can roast, bake, grill, smoke, steam, fire. And it now also has an infrared rotisserie system that can fulfill all your infrared cooking needs. It costs about $8,000. And the purpose of the Grand Turbo, I understand, is not so that you'll buy the Grand Turbo, because who would? Well, someone is, but generally you don't buy the Grand Turbo. But what it does, if you go into barbecues galore and you see the Grand Turbo and it costs $8,000, you're not going to buy that, but it certainly means that you're not happy with the $100 unit that's out in the corner. And it means you might consider the Riani Monaco outdoor unit, which is a mere $2,399. And the Riani Monaco outdoor unit, listen to the advertisement on the flyer as you consider buying this barbecue. It says, a testimonial, I love the look on my neighbour's face when I roll out my Monaco. Early 80s, you've got the cast iron thing. Now you've got this thing, and the joy, the pleasure they derive from it is how sad it makes the guy that lives next to you. If the sin of the right is greed, then the sin of the left is envy. And where do we stand? Well, the teacher has some things to say to us as we struggle with the dissatisfaction of wealth. In chapter 5 and verse 15, he says, everyone comes naked from their mother's womb, and as they come, so they depart. They take nothing from their toil, and they carry nothing in their hands. The teacher, as we know, is one who wants to confront us with life at the extreme. And you don't get more extreme than the day of your birth or the day of your death. And he wants you to take you to both those places in your imagination and to say that there, when you were born naked. And when you die, you take nothing with you. There was an aristocratic woman in England a few years ago who was buried, and someone was cheeky enough to ask the vicar at the graveside, said, how much did she leave? And the vicar replied, she left everything. Look at chapter 5 and verse 18. This is what I've observed to be good, that it's appropriate for people to eat, to drink, and to find their satisfaction in their lawyer. Verse 9, not their lawyer, their... that's a whole other topic. In their labour. Verse 19, when God gives people wealth and possession and the ability to enjoy it, to accept their lot and to be happy from their toil, this is a gift of God. See, the Bible is so anti-greed and so anti-envy, but it's not therefore anti-material possession. In fact, it wants to reorient you to the things of this world in a way that you can truly enjoy them as a creature of God, receiving the tokens of the grace of God. If I can put it this way, most of us, I think, see the logic in buying a CD or a plant. Because, you know, a CD you can play again and again, and a plant just keeps growing. And Ecclesiastes says, consider the value of a concert or cut flowers. Because a concert doesn't last forever. It's a moment and then it's gone. And cut flowers don't last forever. They fill your house and then they're gone. And it makes sense for us to buy the thing that we possess. And Ecclesiastes says, when you're born you possess nothing, and when you die you possess nothing. And so really you don't even possess these things that you think you do. The CD that gets scratched, and the plant that itself eventually dies. He wants to reorient ourselves to life, to see our possessions and our wealth as gift, not as possession, as a thing to receive, not as a thing to grasp onto. And so maybe there's wisdom in the concert, in the flowers, in the thing that reminds you of your humanity, in that discipline of receiving the grace of the moment, rather than possessing, like Gollum's ring, the very thing that will eventually destroy you. Which is another way of saying his key theological theme, which is fear God. The message of the book of Ecclesiastes is that you and I are not God. And much of the misery in our lives is brought about by the belief that we are what we're not. But we're not God. We are his creatures. And as his creatures, the book of Ecclesiastes invites us to learn to receive grace rather than to possess that which cannot be truly possessed. In the New Testament, the Apostle Paul says, "Godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of it." It's a great meditation on that thought, isn't it? To say that godliness, to be aligned in heart and mind with our Creator, and contentment, ironically, he says, that's great gain. Because to possess contentment is to be able to possess all things joyfully and to let go of all things without despair. In verse 8 of that chapter that Paul says, he says we need food and clothing. He's not talking about grinding poverty, and the Bible certainly doesn't say to those in grinding poverty that they should chum up and be happy. But to those of us who have enough, it dares us to live lives where we say, actually, I'm content. Actually, that's enough. Actually, my happiness doesn't need to be indexed against my relationship to that person. It can be indexed against my capacity to receive gifts from the hand of my Creator. The Bible indeed celebrates wealth in the sense that it celebrates a world made by God. It doesn't condemn the material world. So in the Bible, sex and shopping and plants and chocolates and bodies and trees and ice cream and chips with gravy and chicken salt on them are all good things and in themselves not to be condemned. They can be used for evil, but they are not in themselves contaminating. And so the Bible invites us, and Ecclesiastes invites us, to delight in the material world precisely by not wanting to possess it. To enjoy Tosca or Sufjan Stevens or caramelised onion on steak. To allow these things to delight us for the things that they are, and not to try to possess them in a way that we never can. One of the great Christian habits that I commend to you is the practice of saying grace. Many Christians, before an evening meal and even before other meals, will be in the habit of saying grace, which is a wonderfully countercultural kind of occupy this moment stance. Because by saying grace, you refuse greed and envy. By saying grace, by saying thank you to your Creator God, at that moment you declare against both greed and envy and receive as gift. And G.K. Chesterton says this about grace. You say grace before meals, all right. But Chesterton says, I say grace before the concert and the opera. Grace before the play and the pantomime. Grace before I open a book, and grace before stretching, painting, swimming, fencing, boxing, walking, planting, dancing. Grace before I dip the pen in the ink. One of the most radical things you and I can do to reorient ourselves to wealth in the way that God teaches is by saying grace and receiving in the moment the things that God gives us. Finally, and as we finish, the Lord Jesus, who spoke very little about sex, spoke an awful lot about wealth. In fact, it was by far, his most common topic. And you might think of Jesus as just this kind of wild left-wing hippie, and there's certainly some of that going on, but not at the level of wanting to disbandon all the things of the world. In fact, Jesus' mission and Jesus' address to us isn't telling us to stop loving, to stop desiring, but to change that which we desire. He said once, "Do not store up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and where rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." You see, Jesus addresses the people of his day and addresses us and talks about a radical change of the human heart. Not changing that we desire, but changing what we desire. Jesus talks about a whole process, and Christianity invites you into a process, not where there are things that you want, but now you can't have them, but where a heart is changed so that the things that you want are things that truly change, that are truly good, and that truly bring benefit to you and to your community.